So as most of you know, we're spending this whole year on the paramis, qualities of the heart. And while they're not essentially sequential, they actually all support each other. Looking at them that way for just a minute, we can get some insights. Some of you might have been here a few weeks back when Tiweri was giving a talk on patience, and she described the first six paramis this way. The first four of generosity, sila or morality, renunciation and wisdom act to light the fire of the heart. She says it's the kind of heart that leads us in these practices of the paramis. And it's a heart that is fierce, steady, strong, and stout. And then energy, when it's in balance, primes us for action. It's the kind of right energy that my Sunday morning colleague Arv described more like how we write a picture on the wall and you align it and it's in balance. Right in that way as opposed to right and wrong. And then patience comes next. And Tiweri said she described it as the parami that leads us into action. It accepts the world just as it is. And it's the quality that allows us to experience life just as it is. This moment without expectation. And now we come to the seventh month and the seventh parami of truthfulness. And I kind of wondered, well, why is this parami showing up now? And actually, why is there even a parami of truthfulness? Because we already looked at sila, and of course truthfulness is a big part of that. We don't lie, we don't participate in deceit. Truthfulness is also a part of the other paramis. So when we were working with generosity and we noticed those moments of stinginess, we noticed when we weren't feeling generous, and we're really being honest with ourselves about that. We noticed when we were looking at renouncing unskillful habits and we saw the truth of all of our resistance to that. Wisdom, truthfulness is kind of central element of that. And with both energy and patience, we needed to get to connect with our sense of what is actually happening, the truth of the moment, to understand where our energy was, whether it was hyped up or calm or balanced or unbalanced. And as we've been contemplating patience all through July, we've seen how we're either honestly abiding with or bearing with the moment or resisting it. So I wondered about this parami of truthfulness. How's it different and why is it here in this order? So on Sundays, the five of us who teach there, we've been looking at four books. And you can find them on the website. If you just go to Sunday, you'll see the resources. And there are books on the paramis, and one's by Norman Fisher, who's a Zen priest. One's by Sylvia Borstein, who teaches at Spirit Rock. One is by Ajahn Suchito, who's of the Thai forest tradition. And one is by this woman, Gail Stark, who went through a whole year of practice with Joseph Goldstein, who's part of the teaching at IMS, on the paramis. So I consulted our source material and found that Ajahn Suchito had a lot to tell me. He says that this parami is both an aspect of morality, going back to sila, but it also refers to perception, to the ability to see or know things in an undistorted way. He says, this is the truthfulness of the mind and the Dhamma, the entire Dhamma. He calls this parami the fullness of truth. And as I considered his words, I realized that this parami of truthfulness is really about taking a very deep dive into honesty. Honesty with ourselves, honesty with our minds. So this evening, I'm going to do two things. I'd like us to explore what this deep dive of the fullness of truth means. And we're going to do that mostly by talking about a sutta that describes the four distortions of mind. And then I'm going to talk some about some practices that I think might be really helpful as we take this deep dive. It's really asking us to see our delusions, our fantasies, all the BS in the mind, and call it that. It's asking us to know the difference between preference and truth, know the difference between an emotion that's arisen in the moment and the truth of the way things are. It's honoring the way that life unfolds naturally. It's the truth of knowing that this thought, this state of mind is not permanent, and we don't have to take birth in it, take it on as our identity. This truthfulness is really about the practice of discernment writ large. It's taking all those insights we've discovered and taking them off the shelf wherever we've stored them, and really using them fully in our daily practice. So we're invited into this deep dive into truthfulness. So this sutta on the four distortions of mind, the suttas are organized in such an interesting way. They're the numerical discourses where they organize it by ones, twos, threes, fours, fives, and goes on. So the five recollections are in the fives, and the four distortions are in the fours. It's somebody had their thinking cap on. One of the translators of this sutta calls them errors of judgment, errors of view. Remember that the very first fold of the Eightfold Path is wise view. Joseph Goldstein refers to them as the four hallucinations of perception. So this is how the sutta begins, and it's called the Vipalasa Sutta, and I have no idea whether I'm pronouncing it correctly. I even asked Steve Wilhelm, who's our local scholar, and he said, just try it phonetically. So that's what I'm doing. And it goes like this. These four, O monks, are distortions of perception, distortions of thought, distortions of view. And here they are. Sensing no change in the changing, sensing pleasure in suffering, assuming self where there is no self, and sensing the unlovely as lovely. So join with me, as for some of us, it'll be the first examination of the four distortions. For others, it'll be familiar, and I find it's always a good reminder. So the first distortion or hallucination is taking what is impermanent to be permanent. We all know the truth of impermanence. You know, we've all seen that live out in our lives. But I think we also all have a bit of an exception list to that list, that truth of impermanence. I know that one of the aspects of my grief when my partner of many years died suddenly was he was on my exceptionalist. You know, I didn't think it was going to happen. People call death a tragedy. Is a death a tragedy, or is it just the recollection that I'm of the nature to die? Someone gets a diagnosis and they go, why me? Well, why not me? We're all in these bodies. When my son had to close a restaurant that he had been part of for 31 years, people were shocked. But, you know, business cultures change, rents rise. All things are impermanent. They arise and they pass away. Aging, illness, and death, they were the divine messengers that the Buddha used to start on his path to awakening and freedom. And I had us recite the five recollections at the beginning of the sit this evening. It doesn't mean that we aren't grateful for and celebrate all of those aspects of life that we treasure while we have them. The friends and loved ones, our energy, our good health, our cognitive abilities. But what this teaching is asking us to do is to hold these things that we treasure within the same container of that deep knowledge of their fleeting nature. The second hallucination is, and apologies because I'm going in the order from one of the books, Joseph Goldstein's book on mindfulness, which isn't the same order as in the sutta, but we're going to get to all four. So this one, this second hallucination, is taking what is unattractive to be attractive. All the things that we do in our individual lives and in our culture to maintain what we think is an acceptable level of attractiveness. All the business in plastic surgery and dyeing our hair and sometimes excessive or obsessive exercise. The fashion and cosmetic industry is multi-billion dollars. Joseph Goldstein describes it as the mission of that industry is to get us to perceive our human bodies as being more beautiful and perfect than they are. You know, doing all that we can to stay attractive and healthy is a really good thing. There's nothing wrong with that as long as we know what we're doing. We don't deny or dismiss the beauty in our lives, but we understand this hallucination by looking more deeply at when we're caught in so much attachment to beautiful things, that clinging, that lust for beautiful things. When we actually look at the ever-changing nature and inevitable decay of all life, of all objects, we can really see it more clearly. You know, I just had a really big numbered birthday, and I can't do what I used to do. I'm a gardener. I used to spend 5-6 hours in the garden. Now it's 1 to 2. You know, I put in a chairlift I live on the second floor of a warehouse, because someday I'm going to need that chairlift in order to get up there. And all of us have seen those changes. And we need to be honest, they're not beautiful. They're real. So the third hallucination is to take what is unsatisfactory to be happiness. So all the great sense pleasures that we have, sight, hearing, taste, touch, mind. We're so lucky to be born into this human realm. You know, you think of the smell of bread as it bakes, the smell of Daphne blooming in the winter, or sweet peas in the summer, and tasting delicious foods, and that first ripe tomato in your garden, or feeling the touch of a loved one, or that exquisite skin of a newborn baby. You know, being awestruck by the morning sunrise or listening to an amazing piece of music. These are really truly gifts of being alive. But what happens when those moments end? And what happens when we find ourselves seeking the next moment and the next moment and the next moment, trying to find one that's either going to be better or just as good as the last one? Much of what the world calls happiness is the enjoyment of these sense pleasures and going from one to the next. You know, go after a hit of pleasure and then the next hit of pleasure. And we're so deluded. This is that part of that distortion of mind, is thinking and believing that maybe the next hit of pleasure is going to be the one. That's going to be the one that's really going to give me the happiness that I'm seeking. It can be really subtle, this particular one, I think. Joseph Goldstein describes how we're often deluded into thinking that the wanting itself is happiness. Have you ever gotten an idea of something you really wanted or an experience you really wanted, and then you just obsess about it and it fills all of your waking moments? And we all often think that that just is, that's happiness right there, until you either get the thing or do the thing. And then there's a kind of relief and release when that finally stops. Certainly in the, you know, wealthy Western culture, we believe that happiness is getting everything we want. Remember that old bumper sticker that he with the most toys wins? You know, I don't know if you, maybe you're too young to know that one, but we know from our practice and from studying the Buddha's words that the Buddha came to understand, and we've come to understand, that all this unceasing wanting, all this seeking, is the very thing that causes our suffering. It doesn't lead to happiness. All that seeking and finding, but it doesn't last. And it's not to deny those moments of happiness, those moments of ease, those moments of a big smile. It's just our relationship with it that sometimes gets distorted. The fourth hallucination is taking what is non-self to be self, or taking what is really impersonal to be all about me and mine. Which, you know, we've all been learning about this, when we were studying the three characteristics of anatta, of selfing. We try to make ourselves into a solid, continuous entity. And this, you know, we're self-referential, I think, we humans by nature. But just as all phenomena arises and pass away, so do we. You know, we see the changes in the body, we take an emotion or a mind state, and we said, oh yeah, I'm this, and you're that. And when one of those identifications becomes so familiar and long-lasting, we really believe this is who I am. We identify with the sensations of the body and the thoughts and emotions as who we are, as being me. You know, we all have our different identities that come from work, or the ways our lives have unfolded. For years, I had the title of the local junk lady. I lived in a junkyard. Then my partner died, and I got rid of all of his junk. 220 tons of it, to be exact. I was also a kayaker. I did 25 years of big sea kayaking trips. I don't kayak anymore. I'm still a landlord, but when I retire in a couple years, I'm going to give away that identity as well. So from the simple and kind of the mundane of my examples to sometimes the more serious and all-inclusive, we come up with these identities. This is who I am. This is the way I am, and I'll always be that way. This is who you are, and this is how you will always be. Leslie and I were just on retreat with Tim and Tiweri at Cloud Mountain. Tim told this wonderful story about himself. When he was a young person in his mid-20s, he was just starting meditation, and he was very, very shy. And he told about his very first meditation retreat, where it took all of every single bit of courage he had to raise his hand and to ask a question. So that back then, Tim's identity was as a shy, timid, kind of scared to put himself out there. And here he is, one of our guiding teachers, and pretty wonderful at that. So I actually added a fifth distortion, although I think it's probably included in the fourth. And what I call it is believing that because something has been so familiar and so part of our habitual thinking and emotion, and it's been around so long, we believe it. Just like, you know, folks who have had difficult childhood and have presented themselves as being timid or afraid or not trusting, and then some healing happens in their lives. And they are no longer these timid, scared, not trusting people. We change, and all of these are ways to keep us from really being with the truth of the way things are. All of these distortions, they're called vipalasas, are distortions of view, somehow believing that if only everything would be great, if only I had the right job, if only I had the right house, or the right sweetie, or the right body, or the right mind, if only this moment were like this. There's a lovely Dharma teacher in our community, Bonnie Duran, who is a friend of Seattle Insight. And many years ago, she gave a talk on distortions. And she said that our culture puts forth the proposition that the perfect what is out there waiting for us, and that our job is finding that perfect what. So the end of this Vipalasa Sutta says, gone astray with wrong views, beings misperceive with distorted minds. When those with wisdom have heard this, they recuperate their right mind. They see change in what is changing, suffering where they're suffering, non-self in what is without self. They see the unlovely as such. By this acceptance of right view, they overcome all suffering. Ajahn Suchito, when he was just directing us into understanding this parami of truthfulness, it's the fullness of truth. It's moving away from the distortions of mind to really examine the truth of our minds, the truth of the way things are. So I'd like to spend the last part of my talk in sharing some ideas about how to practice in this deep dive. The first, I find that the five recollections ground me. I start every meditation with that. It's just like, and each time, sometimes it's illness, sometimes it's death, sometimes it's aging, sometimes it's the loss of loved ones or becoming separate. I have a different response to it, but I find it really grounds me. If that doesn't work for you, find something else in the Dhamma. It might be the Four Noble Truths, might be one or more of the Eightfold Path, maybe starting out your sit every morning with reading something from the Dhammapada. But find something for yourself that grounds you in the way things are right now, the truth of things. And you're going to know what's going to work for you. I think another practice that's really important is to remember why you're on the path. Why do you come and sit together? What's your aspiration? How do you define freedom for yourself? What does awakening mean? You know, and I like reminding myself that the Buddha said that if he didn't believe that we could all do this, he wouldn't ask it of us. So in case you get filled with a lot of doubt, I think that can be helpful. Sims has an amazing talk library. You may not know this, but you go on the website and it's fabulous. So I recently re-listened to the talks from a 2016 non-residential retreat with Christina Feldman on Nibbana. She reminds us, unfortunately, Christina doesn't travel to the States anymore, but you can listen to a lot of her talks on our website and also on Dhamma Seed. She reminds us that a lot of people, especially in the West, don't believe in their own possibility for awakening, for liberation. So I think connecting to your aspiration is really important. And of course, establishing a whole series of questions for yourself that you ask yourself over and over again. I think many of us who are longtime meditators, even in our daily lives, thoughts will come and the question goes, is that true? I don't think that's true. You know, you're in conversation with somebody or you look at someone and they kind of gave you a look and you go, oh, they're doing this. Then you go, wait a second. I have no idea what was going on in that person's head. So, but expand that kind of question of, is this true? Am I observing my acts of body, mind, and speech truthfully? In Gail Stark's book, where she is in constant conversation with Joseph Goldstein about all the paramis, she and Joseph both point out to watch for habits that give rise to moments of almost true. And this can be tricky, but I think most of us know, like in speech, there are times when we kind of exaggerate a story, partly to maybe make ourselves look better, or if the story is a little more interesting. Or when you think about, how do you give feedback? Or are you willing to give feedback? What's your relationship with truth and speech? There are a lot of ways to look at truthfulness as it manifests in your daily lives. It can be a really important committed practice. I think another piece is to encourage those qualities that will allow you to have a really honest and gentle examination. For me, I need to find ways to relax in order to look at the hard stuff. I revisited a couple months ago when we were talking about renunciation, I shared that I had been spending some weeks renouncing worry. Now, worry just happens. It's just a natural thing of mind. But I was doing a lot of feeding of this worry. And when I sat with it and I felt it in my body and I just kind of allowed it to be there and I didn't do any feeding, there was such a sense of relaxation. And right after that, there was clearer seeing. So for me, that's one of the qualities that I need in order to examine the harder stuff. Ask the question for yourself, what helps you have that? You're the only one in the mirror, you know, having that hard conversation about what's true in your own life. How are you deluding yourself? How are you denying yourself? How are you hanging out in fantasy? Another practice, which for those of you who've come to Sundays, you'll recognize this because there's always somebody who reminds us that when we're dealing with hard stuff, we need to be kind to ourselves. We need to be gentle. Tuwheri, when she was describing the kind of heart that you need in order to do these paramis, she said, fierce, steady, strong, and stout. And those are really powerful adjectives. But this is not another opportunity to scold yourself or berate yourself or do a lot of self-recriminating. This deep dive could lead that way, but I think it's important to remember how to be gentle. The mind, these minds do what the minds do. When, you know, we've all learned that part. You're sitting there and you're quiet and you're focused on your body or the breath, and all of a sudden, some kind of like multimedia show happens in the mind and you go, where in the hell did that come from? You didn't ask for it. I mean, that's what the minds do. So right away, you can give yourself a little bit of break that we did not create this. This is all the conditions of our lives. This is where we are right now. This is what's happening in the mind right now. So there's a nun that has come and spoken at Clear Mountain Monastery on Saturday mornings, and she said this fabulous thing. She talked about all the issues that she's dealing with in her life, and they're pretty heavy. And her teacher said, yeah, all those issues came from the outside, but it's your story now. So what are you going to do about it? So you can be gentle, knowing that you didn't ask for all this. You didn't ask to be a deluded person who's going off being, you know, in fantasy all the time, but now you are. So what are you going to do about it? And it takes commitment to the path and to your practice. If somebody could turn off their cell phone, that would be lovely. It always happens, so it's not, don't be embarrassed, just find it. Our founding teacher would have gone ballistic with that. But then we had this beautiful teacher visiting us from Olympia, and somebody's cell phone went off, and she goes, isn't that a lovely sound? So a little different perspective. So be gentle, but also be tough. Joseph Goldstein has a wonderful way of talking about how to deal with repeated unwholesome states of mind. He says, cut off their heads and don't go down that road. So be tough with yourself. You can be gentle, but just, you know, the mind's going to send you what it's going to send you. Thank you very much. No, thank you. We're not going there. If you have a regular metta practice, do many people have a metta practice? Often the first phrase is, may I be safe and protected from inner and outer harm. Know what the inner harm is. For me, living in fantasy is inner harm. What is it for you? How do you address that inner harm? Sometimes it's believing in all the self-doubt. Sometimes it's that blaming oneself or constantly judging, clinging to a sense of who you think you are as a self. So really finding out what inner harm means for you. So some of us are so judgmental that we have a hard time seeing the good. And some of us have an inflated self-image and have a hard time seeing the not so good. But this is a deep dive. And it's a very exciting opportunity to go from where we started with generosity and morality, renunciation, energy, patience. And we're ready for this. We're ready to really look, what's the truth of the way things are? And this is where the refuge of the Sangha comes in. Find a Sangha buddy who's willing to do the deep dive together, to do some talking with each other. Wow, I've found I'm really, you know, so attached to this kind of fantasy living of, you know, thinking that, oh, if I just, you know, move here, everything's going to be great. Talk to somebody who speaks the same Dhamma language. Utilize each other for that. And then practice with some humor. Sometimes when something comes up in my mind, I just start laughing and I go, really? Again? This, you know, I thought we dealt with this already, you know. Smile at this process. It's serious business, but we don't always have to be quite so serious in doing it. So again, Gail Stark from her book, she says that she can see why truthfulness would have come before the next one, which is resoluteness. She calls that a warrior mode. She said that it helps to not go forth fighting windmills instead of one's real battles. So with this truthfulness, we're going to see what the real battles are. what are we really dealing with in terms of not being true to ourselves or not being true to the Dhamma? And she reminds us, this is no passive undertaking. It's an awakening process. The last thing I think is, and people are probably already doing this, you know, we sit on our cushions and we settle down and we close our eyes and we breathe deeply and clear seeing happens. It's kind of amazing. You close our eyes and clear seeing happens. We learn so much about our minds on the cushion, and we get some wonderful aha moments. And those moments of understanding, and we see our clinging and our resistances, and we see the truth of impermanence and non-self and of dukkha, and we see how we add that second arrow to difficult circumstances. But then once you've had those insights, make it 24/7. Really take it out with you. Really practice that. In work, in family situations, when you're just walking down the street, really take those insights. See how truthfulness or avoiding truthfulness, where it shows up, how it shows up. I think it's in that real living when we take all of this with us, that these truths of the way things are really becomes known at a cellular level. They become really embodied. So I wish you well in this month on truthfulness. And of course, it's not like we stop one parami and then, you know, well, I'm done with sila, now I'm doing this one. But this is a real opportunity to look at that deep dive into truthfulness. So thank you very much for your attention. And we've got a nice amount of time to hear anybody's reflections, how this is showing up for you, being with the way things actually are in your lives, how you're seeing some of the delusion or the fantasy or the denial. Or also feel free to share about how this whole practice with the paramis has been for you. I find it very rich, and I'm so glad we're spending the whole year on it. The local Dharma leaders, we've done a couple day-longs on it. It's way too short to deal with all 10, but you get a taste. So there's a microphone. Yeah. Cheryl has it, and she's willing to take it around. And if anybody on Zoom, if you go to the bottom of your screen and you'll see where it'll say raise hand or reactions, and feel free to do that. And I'd love to hear how does this sit with you? And if you could say your name, that would be great too.
Hello. Hey, I'm Blake.
Hi, Blake.
I had a question about the vipalasas. I understand the three that relate to the three characteristics. I'm just surprised by the fourth.
The one about the attractive and the unattractive?
Yeah. Could you speak to that a little?
Can you, I would be happy to. But also, is there more to that, the puzzlement? Did you want to share anything more to flesh out the question?
I mean, I don't recall anything in the suttas about unattractiveness mm-hmm. or attractiveness.
It's more about the confusion. You know, the monks with the Buddha, and I am far from a scholar, but the Buddha would encourage the monks to sit with decaying bodies. And in the first foundation of mindfulness, the one on the body, we're encouraged to really examine the not quite so lovely parts, the phlegm, the pus, the urine, the feces, the decay, and I think it's to get more connected to the truth that these are temporary beings with temporary beauty, and also I think for me I think it's pointing us in the direction of where do we really find the beauty, and not in the shiny objects, but rather in the kind of the essence of life. I it would be a great question to also ask to Ari and Tim, and they might have a deeper response. But I think it's really saying it's this, all the four distortions, I think, are inviting us to be with the truth of the way things are in the moment and not put a shiny gloss on stuff. So that's my, and if anybody has another sense of that, feel free to add, and thanks for that question. Yes. I'm just checking to make sure nobody on Zoom. Cheryl, did you see right here?
Is there somebody on Zoom?
No, there isn't. You're good. What's your name?
I'm Austin.
Hi, Austin.
Hello. Obviously, I didn't prepare to share, so I'm speaking in the moment. But one of the things that came up for me is, in the sit, things as they are include both what has been and what is emergent in me. And the experience I had in the sit was just really sensing my ancestors. And I was in a place where I was born recently, and with a cousin who's older. And in the sit, I had a memory of being children in a house that we both drove by together. And it hadn't hit me until my sit. It just emerged, the memory. I had totally lost that memory, and it mm-hmm. came to me. Mm-hmm. And just how sublime that experiences just over the weekend, driving literally by an old abandoned house that many years ago we were children playing in. So I share that to name just the truthfulness of this moment as it really is. I think what I'm experiencing in my body, that it includes both what has been and what is emergent in the mm-hmm. present, that there are there is residue even in our facial features and our habit patterns from the past, and even what's coming because of dependent origination is in the present as well, like mm-hmm. Apple tree and just the seed. Apple tree seed, there is that apple tree. So, and I wanted to close just by saying on this thing about truthfulness is, you know, my ancestors, you know, during enslavement, memory was a very important, wholesome and skillful response to go through oppression and to be able to find a grounding. Memory mm-hmm. served that purpose. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the longing and hope and that something might be different on the other side for their mm-hmm. future generations mm-hmm. was grounding. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm sensing is that there are wholesome and unwholesome ways to relate to the past, to our memory, and wholesome and unwholesome ways to even lean into that longing and emergence. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious what you think about that. Thank you.
Thank you, Austin. So one of the first thoughts is about, you know, we are all a product of all of the conditioning, our lineage, our ancestors, what the stories we were raised with, the challenges, I come from a family that, while we didn't have any Holocaust survivors in my immediate family, there were in the larger family. And so that being sensitive to oppression and hatred was kind of, I was raised with that. I think that this is just a white person's view that if black folks in this country didn't hold on to both the past and the future, I don't think there would have been as much strength in the community that there is. I think that was part of what gave, I don't know how you would see that. You know, when we're sitting, we're encouraged to notice when we're in the past or the future and just stay in the present. But our practice is way bigger than that. You know, it's understanding, how is it that this being is this way? Where did this all come from? You know, where did certain sensitivities come from, certain insights, blockages, neurotic responses? Understanding that, I think, is really important. I think, you know, during the sits, trying to go, okay, there's all of this was there, got it. Bring yourself back to what's happening right now. And feeling, you were talking about feeling the response that your body had from that memory and, you know, acknowledging it. But I don't think we don't throw it out with, you know, throw it out. I think it's part of the gift of who we are. I thank you for your sharing of your what was going on in your practice today. Yeah. I'm just checking nobody on Zoom. Okay, please. Hi.
Hi, I'm Michelle.
Hi, Michelle.
And what I was thinking of saying, I think, actually ties in a little. There's, I think, one meditation practice where we can use our imagination to send love and metta to ourselves back when we were a child, or even to those our forebears. And I have been focusing my own practice on self-metta for several weeks now, and on the instructions of one of the members of this group who told me to come here so that I could be surrounded by Sangha. I have found that to be extremely powerful, and I find it also fortuitous that I came for the first time when it's truthfulness, because so much of this has been about providing the gentleness toward myself so that I could see some of my delusions. And I've had a lot of aha moments in the last several weeks of doing this daily self-metta practice, where I have realized, for example, that I thought I would be compassionate towards others, and that I would shed tears, for example, if I were watching a movie where I felt very compassionate toward, for example, a documentary where were little girls. And I realized, I'm actually feeling, if I could be that way about myself, that there's actually a lot of stored tears that I have been taught to push down and to not feel, to be numb and kind of checked out with my own emotions. And so I feel like this is a truthfulness that is very different from the Sheila type of truthfulness, because I didn't ever realize I was doing it. Certainly it did not feel like it was for immoral reasons. It was what I was taught to do. Also feeling judgmental about other people and not realizing that I was doing it, but that it was a defense mechanism so that that person wouldn't have a chance to reject me. So things like that. It's just been really an emotional process, but I think that if had I come here before doing the self-metta practice and listened to this self-delusion discussion, I would have been like, nope, I'm fine, not doing that. Wow. So I'm sure I have many more delusions to discover, but it's good to be in a safe place where that can happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. There's also I appreciate the Theravadin tradition, the Vipassana tradition that we're in, and the way it has manifested through the lineage of the teachers, that where there's not, it's either this way or not. This is the way you got to do it. Because what you were saying is that there was a sense inside of you of what was needed, what that heart, body, mind was calling for. And I'm grateful that you found, that you were able to listen to it, because sometimes the volume isn't loud enough and we don't really know. It takes longer for us to find what's the right way, for us to find a path into, there's a lot of layers. I've known folks who have spent entire years or 1 year or many years on just one small teaching. Well, small, but it's big. You know, like I've been in a Dharma group. We spent a couple years just on wise speech. We met every single month and had a different perspective each time, and learned so much by going deeper and deeper. And I really honor your practice, and it's finding, you're finding a way that is meaningful for you. Thanks for sharing that. I appreciate it. Anyone online want to share anything about how truthfulness is showing up, or any thoughts? While we're waiting, that over the years we've had a lot of teachings on delusion, and somebody always asks the question, how do you know if you're deluded? Because, you know, the mind is just sending you its stuff. And I think these teachings give you a couple doorways of looking at it. And spending quiet time looking, examining your minds and seeing what's in there, what's coming up, what's the story that's being told to you over and over and over again. And when you play it out, is it wholesome? Is it skillful? Where is it leading to? What's it in service of? And, you know, we often, a few years ago when we were doing the Four Noble Truths, I think it seemed like Tiwari started every talk with do no harm. And do no harm to ourselves or to anybody else. And when you really start examining something that's such a pithy little saying, you can see that there are a lot of subtle ways that we do harm to ourselves and others. And some of it is by having less than a fully present relationship with truthfulness. This on Sunday, I was in a breakout group where we shared a couple different ways that truthfulness in speech comes up. One person shared, and I really identified with this one, where you've got somebody in your life who you really care about and they're going through a really hard time. And this person was talking about how they responded to somebody who was having a hard time, And their response had way more to do with this person wanting to feel better themselves than helping the person who was having a hard time. It was such an honest sharing, and I could really identify with that. I don't know about the rest of you, that, you know, you're trying to make the other person feel better, but you're uncomfortable. You don't want to be around somebody who's having such a hard time, whether it's physically or emotionally or whatever. So there's this is kind of subtle work. And I think it's exciting, though, and really connected to the other paramis as well. Anyone else? Please. Oh, good, Judith. Judith, go ahead. Thank you.
Okay. It seems to me that the truth is, it's like it's elusive and it keeps coming in different layers. And like I have, I have this realization. And then later on, it starts to shift. And all of a sudden, it's, no, maybe it's this. And so I'm beginning to think that the truth is this, even the impermanence of my realizations. And that the truth is that there's really nothing to hang on to. Like, okay, yeah, I figured this out. I fixed it. And then, it shifted again. That makes sense?
It makes a lot of sense to me. It's part of the thing of keep being awake, keep being present, and pay attention to those shifts of what's happening. Maybe you're getting more information. Maybe you've realized, I thought this was really the way things are for me, but what's all this turmoil going on in my body about it? Maybe I need to pay attention to that and see if I'm not quite at ease with this as I thought I was. So thank you for reminding us of that. Yes, please. Oh, no, can you get a microphone? That way the people on Zoom can hear you as well. And please share your name first.
My name is Edmund. So the question is, since you mentioned truth, how about these so-called noble truths? Are they testable in terms of, or are they just kind of like religious statements in a sense of you cannot test it, you cannot prove it, you cannot, examine. Like, for example, in science, you know, if you have some kind of statement or hypothesis, you have to prove it, right? Otherwise, it's not going to be accepted in the community. It will just die out. So in this case, going back to these noble truths, are they testable? Can we examine it? Can we test it? Can we see it? If this is true?
It's a fabulous question, and I think the answer is yes, yes, yes. And I'll guide you to a really fabulous book by Philip Moffat, where he goes through the Four Noble Truths, but there are three levels to each one, three insights. And the proving of it, to use your language, is what we do with it. So the first noble truth is that there is suffering, and we are encouraged to really experience how suffering or dissatisfaction happens in our lives and minds, to really understand it. And the second noble truth is, what is the cause of this unhappiness, which is the clinging to things, wanting things to last when they don't, adding those second arrows of thoughts on top of uncomfortable or dissatisfying situations that come up. And the same thing of the three different levels, three insights. The third is that there is understanding that there is a way that kind of unhappiness or suffering can end. And again, it's by letting go of the clinging and following the Eightfold Path. So whether it could be scientifically proved, No, but I think it can be proved in terms of one's own inner life experience, where for me, I've seen some of my second arrows, for instance, you know, where something negative happens and then I add all this crap onto it. And then I'm really unhappy. Whereas the first one was an ouch, but it wasn't a disaster. So when I've seen how I add to my own level of discomfort by distorted thoughts, by avoiding reality, all the different ways, or believing old emotional decisions I made as a young person, when I've had that experience and I go, oh, right, I could feel the pain in my body. I could see what the behaviors I was doing as a result of it. So for me, I felt approving to, you know, that of the truth. And in Philip's book, he talks about when the truth of it has really been embodied, that's when it becomes ennobled. When you really understand it at a deep cellular, emotional, heart, body, mind level. How does that land for you? That's the way I would respond to that question, which is a totally legitimate question. You're okay? Okay. Maybe we'll have a chance to continue it at some point. Is there any, Jean Canning? Hi, Jean.
Hi, Suze. Thank you for this talk. I really enjoyed it. I appreciate it. In particular, I liked your practice aids that you gave us, starting with the five remembrances, the Dhamma. I really enjoy the Sangha. I find that being in company with fellow seekers just enriches my whole process. And why am I on this path when I think about that, and what are my aspirations? They really inspire me to stick with it through thick and thin. There's been a whole lot of thick. Maybe it's because I'm thick-headed, but there's been a lot of thick in this process for me, but just staying with it has been so infinitely rewarding. So I just thank you for bringing those forth.
You're so welcome, and you're sharing that sometimes there's been the thick. You know, I think if we went around both this room and the Zoom room and ask folks, hey, if there have been any hard times coming your way, you know, I think we'd all say, we could all list them. And what does this practice do for us in how we deal with those really rough times? I've shared a lot with the Sunday sit. Just a few days. So my partner of 35 years went out for a run one day and had a rip in his aorta and died within a minute. He was just a big guy, like the Ever Ready battery. He was just strong and healthy and guess not. Anyway, he died. And I felt like my world had flipped upside down. And one of my Dharma teachers gave me this mantra, which has continued for me for these 7 years, which is, may I trust in the natural unfolding of life. And I've added to that, may I receive that natural unfolding with understanding and wisdom. And it's my practice that made that mantra meaningful and alive for me, because it was like, well, what do I even mean by trusting the natural unfolding of life? And it had to do with anicca. You know, life happens and there's arisings and passings away, and it had to do with the five recollections. everyone and everything I hold dear is subject to change. Yes. I will become separate from them. You know, whether I noticed some months ago that I was changing some of the words, and on that recollection, I'd say, and I might become separate from them. And then I just went, uh-oh, you know, no, the truth is I will become separate from them. And does it touch my heart? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yes. I think that there's so much in this practice that is available for us to navigate what are some really rough waters. Some of us have rougher waters that we're swimming in right now, and some, they're not, you know, the waters are a little calmer. But there's so much here. It's like Michelle was saying, with self-metta has been part of what is helping her go through the rough waters. And Austin is saying connecting to some of the past and the future and memories, that helps. I always find that laughter helps me a lot. I come from a family that had a peculiar sense of humor, but we laughed at a lot of stuff, even some really harsh things. And that has helped me. What helps other people? Maybe even just shout them out and I can repeat it for the Zoom folks. What helps you make it through those rough times? Anybody?
Present moment.
Present moment. How does that help you? Everything's all right right now.
Happiness right here, right now.
Right here, right now.
Otherwise, my brain will take it.
Yeah, otherwise you can't see, but Leslie said otherwise my brain will just take it somewhere else. So right here, right now. How about anybody else? What helps navigating those rough waters? I know that Jean on Sunday morning has this beautiful little sign that he might share. There it is. Love you, Sangha. There's a reason why it's one of the three refuges. Please, Sally.
I like taking photos.
That's so intimidating. I started taking photos, maybe 4 or 6 weeks ago, just nothing special, but just of moments of my day, you know, pretty things I noticed or things that made me laugh, and I go back and look at them, and it just reminds me that every day, no matter how bad that day was overall, there were beautiful moments. I saw the moon rise over Green Lake, and it was transformative, you know, or whatever it was. So, just to have an actual, like, picture.
Wow, great idea. And that the underlying message that in this moment, I remember it was only a few weeks after Bill died, and I live along on Lake Union, and I was walking along the canal. It was one of those gorgeous fall days. The water had a certain kind of color, and the light was just shining, and I was sitting looking at the water, and my mind asked me, you know, what's this moment like? And there was nothing wrong with this moment, even though my life partner had died. In that moment, everything was just beautiful and lovely. And I think that's part of equanimity, which is our last parami of the both and. It doesn't, in equanimity, at least my understanding of it, it's not that everything's hunky-dory. It's just that there's both and. Please, Michelle. It's coming at you.
I recently read the book Self-Compassion by Kristen Neff, and also informed by this same type of practice. And she has a lot of self-soothing techniques. Even just, I find, putting my hand on my other arm and just being there, like, for myself, it's a good reminder. And I think she says that there's a chemical It's the same as when you are being hugged by somebody. So you can give that to yourself.
Yeah, nice. We used to have a visiting teacher who's also from Canada and doesn't come here anymore, Heather Martin. Her approach was to go, "There, there, honey." I've adopted her "there, there, honey." We just have another minute. Are there any announcements that need to be made tonight? Not today? Okay. Do go on the website. There's a lot happening in September. There's going to be some very visiting teachers, a day-long, couple day-longs, a new beginning class starting. And join us Tuesday and Thursday morning, drop-in sits, Sunday morning, Thursday night, of course, Monday night. We have a wonderful, vibrant Sangha, and I'm happy to be here. Let's just close with kind of a dedication of merit. It took me the longest time to understand what that even meant. But it's something that Buddhists do, which I think is really lovely. It's to acknowledge the sincerity, the honesty, the vulnerability, the wisdom that is being shared in both parts of our Sangha tonight, on Zoom and in person. And the power of this practice and the power of the Dhamma and the Buddha's words. And we offer the merit, the benefits that come from all of what we have shared. And we offer it out there beyond this room, beyond this Zoom experience, to those in our immediate lives, to those in our greater Seattle community, for those of you who are outside of Seattle, elsewhere, for in your community. And we offer it to people and to beings everywhere. May all beings be free of suffering. May all beings have enough food and shelter, clothing, health care, all of what they need to continue to survive and thrive. May all beings live in peace and with ease. It's as if the bell is saying, "May it be so." I like that. Thanks, everyone. It's been lovely to be with you.